This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue to recognize Black History Month. We confront the efforts of the Trump administration to erase that history. We're joined by Sheila Miller of the National Immigration Law Center, who works at the intersection of immigration and civil rights.
Also today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the nationwide rollback of critical race theory in the context of what used to be known as Black History Month.
Joining us are Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, the publishers of LA Progressive, a daily online magazine widely read throughout the greater Los Angeles area and beyond.
Stay with us.
I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. On Law and Disorder, we're celebrating Black History Month. We remember and honor the ongoing struggle of Black Americans and their allies to achieve equality, justice, and fairness. But the forces of white supremacy have opposed that struggle at every turn. Today, the President of the United States and his enablers are at the forefront of not only dismantling the progress that has been made, but creating new obstacles to impede further progress. On day one, Trump claimed to end birthright citizenship, and he terminated diversity, equity, and inclusion policies and programs throughout the federal government and in companies with federal contracts. He has stepped up deportations and is sending undocumented immigrants to the infamous detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He canceled flights for refugees already approved to travel to the United States. He has threatened to prosecute local officials in sanctuary cities who refuse to cooperate with ICE agents. He froze federal grants and loans designed to support low-income food, housing, and educational programs. All told, in the first 18 days, he issued over 65 executive orders or policy statements that threatened to tear apart the fabric of American society that has been striving, haltingly at times, to achieve equality and justice for all. Meanwhile, the recent devastating fires in Los Angeles have destroyed entire communities in the wealthy Pacific Palisades and in the less wealthy Altadena, which has a special place in the history of African Americans in Los Angeles. Will the ambitious plans to rebuild these destroyed areas favor the rich over the poor, as we saw after Katrina, and in many natural and man-made disasters? To discuss these urgent issues, we've invited Sheila Miller to join us. Sheila serves as Director of Race, Equity, and Inclusion at the National Immigration Law Center and leads the implementation of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, Justice, and Belonging, DEIBJ, initiatives. She's responsible for creating, training, managing, and optimizing all efforts to make the NILC internal workplace a fairer, more equitable environment for all employees. She partners with leaders across the organization to ensure progress toward NILC's vision of being a race-forward, fully inclusive organization. Sheila, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I am so excited to be here, very humbled by receiving the invitation and looking forward to a very robust conversation with you.
Thank you. So do I. We've got a lot to talk about, but first tell us more about the National Immigration Law Center, which was established in 1979. What is its mission and vision? And how do you see its role during the second Trump administration?
Very good question. I got to tell you that the origins of NILC, I want to state that I feel personally it was intentional way back then in 1979. I don't have a clear understanding of what was happening. I was kind of young back then, but still, I know that NILC had a mission. Moving forward, the work that we focused on has always been at the intersection of immigrant, economic, racial justice, civil rights, and the National Immigration Law Center, fondly known as NILC2S. We use a multi-pronged strategy for securing lasting and transformational change. With that being said, we are intentional about building an inclusive future for low-income immigrants and also to have a thorough impact on litigation, which is a happy place for me, policy, advocacy, movement building, narrative change, culture change, storytelling. I think every element and experience of the immigrant experience in the United States, we attempt to cover all areas that that entails. And then I also want to underscore the civil rights piece of that. Also, our work, it draws strength from the partnerships that we build, including partnerships with, I was again looking at the bios and I thought, wow, National Lawyers Guild, ACLU. Yes, very familiar. And we focus on the power of the people in mobilizing through their lived experiences and the expertise of all the communities that we serve. In terms of our mission, it's very simple, really. We want to advance and defend the rights of opportunities for low-income immigrants and their loved ones and their communities. In terms of our vision, Steve, I would say that the vision of NILC is, I like to think of it as organic, because we recognize that I feel that everyone has the freedom to thrive in this society. And it matters not, you know, how much money you make or what neighborhood you live in or even your origins of birth. We're human beings and we're entitled to that merely because we are human beings. And so that's the background there. I hope I answered all your questions.
Yes. In fact, you make me curious. And we love to know what brings people to this work personally, as much as you'd like to share. How long have you been with the organization and what path have you taken that would bring you to this work?
That is a great question. I will start by saying, I humbly say this in respect to my late parents, but I feel I was born a rebel. I do. And I have always fought for justice and the rights of people. It predates me, but it goes, you know, all the way back to a history lesson that I had in grade school. The assignment was to create we had to write a book report on presidents. I refused to write that book report. The history instructor said, well, Sheila, you have a choice. Either you write the book report and select a president of your choice, or you advocate for farm workers in March. And so I said, sign me up. And I didn't tell my parents about it, but I didn't write the book report. None of the presidents resonated with me, even as a young child. And I marched. I marched for freedom. And I've been marching ever since. So in terms of what draws me to the work, my background is in social justice. I have advocated probably in every space possible, be it private or nonprofit, advocating for the rights of colleagues, advocating for access to advancement, advocating for trying to basically demolish this race system even within the city of Los Angeles. And that dear to me, working in the civil rights space at the Legal Defense Fund with icons of the movement, Julius Chambers, Elaine, and also Ted Shaw and others. But I think I was born to do this because it is most passionate for me. And the perfect fit for me was going into the immigrant rights space because, again, it's an area that I feel most comfortable. And it's an area that I feel needs us. It needs me, and I can sleep at night. I spent a little time in securities litigation, plaintiff centered, but I couldn't sleep at night. My conscience kept me up because I didn't feel justice was truly served for the communities that we were and, you know, emboldened to. And so that's how I ended up here. I think it's in my DNA. And I watch my parents as social justice advocates as well. That's my story. It was organic.
Sheila, how would you describe the moment we are in right now politically? How does this moment with a supercharged anti-immigrant, white supremacist, MAGA agenda affect Black and brown communities?
In terms of describing where we are today, in terms of describing the temperature of humanity, I would say it's reached its boiling point. Personally, I feel that there is a deliberate attempt to erode relationships and communities that we have spent decades to form. And in particularly for me, I've been paying close attention to what appears to be this deliberate divide between Black and brown communities and pitting one against the other, all in the name of justice or injustice. That troubles me because we've worked so hard to build communities. Trump 1.0 showed us exactly where his mind was, what he was thinking, and his approach to deliberately dehumanizing humanity with the Muslim ban, right? We are still suffering, some of us, from the trauma from that experience of Trump 1.0. And then he comes back in Trump 2.0. He's, in my opinion, he is merely completing his agenda at rapid pace. There's so many similarities between what is happening with members of our immigrant communities, particularly our brown communities, and that of the civil rights movement. And Steve, I know you would know this because of your background in this area, but, you know, back in the day, from what I understood, Black folks were, you know, pulled aside or, you know, you had to carry around some form of ID to prove that, you know, you were a freed slave. It's no different than what we're seeing now. The only difference is, you know, there's a lighter shade of melanin that we're talking about. But I think the results are very deliberate. And that is an attempt of erasure. And that is an attempt to maintain white supremacy culture. When he said, make America great again, I don't understand why people didn't get it. The man was very bold with what he was saying. My takeaway from that was, you know, we need to return to birth of a nation. I'm troubled by the hate that has shown its boldness in a way I haven't seen before. But I'm not frightened into silence to call it out, because I think we need to do that. Yeah, we could talk about this forever, but we're at a very precarious time, as the old folks used to say. And if boldness were ever needed, I think it's now. I think that we need to stop tiptoeing around the issue of racism, and we need to be very bold and very clear about what we're talking about. And we can provide, we have all the material to provide clear examples of what it looks like, what it feels like, in all areas of our lives.
You are so right. Listening to you itself supercharges me and emboldens me. What you've said reminds me of the questions that have been thrown at us by Trump and his ilk for years now. And that is this attack on DEI, which they've tried to make into a dirty word. They've done it to people being woke. I did some research and found early sermons by Martin Luther King that spoke of awakening, being awake to racism and being woke. And now that's been turned into a dirty word. This is historically deep in the American experience. From your work and studies, where do you see this attack on DEI and woke coming from? Has Trump tapped into a deep American vein in doing so? And what are your concerns about how so much of of his argument seemed to be resonating at least with almost half of the American voters.
I think for me personally, there has always been an attempt to demean, particularly the Black race, right? And I want to restate that I personally do not identify as Black. I identify as a person of African descent. Because as I share with those who listen, you can't minimize my experience, my contributions, my legacy to a crayon and a Crayola box, right? Black does not define me, nor does brown define our Latino, Latina. We need to take back what is naturally ours first and foremost in order to change the rhetoric, right? And we know that using the term Black oftentimes is a very demeaning term. It goes back to the N-word. It goes back to the coon. It goes back to everything that is anything but positive and good. I think that Trump and his folks feel that the word, you know, to attempt to demean diversity, equity, inclusion will have the same impact that the N-word had back in the day. But what they're not focused on and what they're not realizing is that no longer impacts me and those like me. When you take a term of diversity, equity, and inclusion, why don't you say what you say and mean what you mean? You want to reverse the civil rights movement. You want to reverse the rules of law that state that we are all entitled to be treated with a level of decency despite the color of our skin, right? And it's kind of comical. I mean, I think if we could take back the power that we naturally have and turn it back on them, we would get a different outcome. But for Trump to stand up and make a comment about DEI hires, it didn't resonate with me because I didn't know what he was talking about until I realized this attempt to demean the term itself. I think what's really interesting, though, with the outcome, Steve, is that many of those benefiting from DEI don't look like me, right? There are white colleagues and others that have benefited from DEI, and yet they have become the victim of this deliberate attempt at erasing Black history, erasing Black literature, erasing Black folks, right? And so I think the attempt is kind of comical if we can see the power that we hold to change the outcome. And that goes back to the boldness that we have to take. We've already marched, right? You have marched. We have marched. We've already done that. We've already went to the courts and we have made huge, huge progress. We've already done that. It's time for us to be bold and it's time for us to feel empowered to stand in our truth and speak it. Otherwise, it's presumed that we don't know what they're saying. It goes over our head and that we will just succumb to whatever's said by Trump and his racist gang.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, your host, and today we're joined by Sheila Miller from the National Immigration Law Center. Sheila, let's get even more specific. Your organization has launched an initiative to help support the rebuilding of Altadena. Tell listeners more about Altadena, its importance to the Black community as a haven from discriminatory redlining in Southern California, and explain why you fear that the ambitious plans to rebuild L.A. will favor the rich over the poor, as we saw after Katrina and in so many other disasters.
Steve, thank you for that question. I've thought a lot about it since the fires, and I have to say that this is history repeating itself. And when you mention Katrina, it's absolutely true. We're still trying to recover from when the levees broke. We're still trying to recover from the uprising of the Rodney King horrific beating and how the city went up in flames. We're still traumatized and trying to recover from Black Wall Street. We're still trying to recover Crenshaw, right? So the fact is that the fires that destroyed Altadena, it hit me personally because not only did I have family members who lost their homes, but colleagues and their families and friends. And it was a little enclave that I myself felt comfortable walking the streets when I would visit and felt safe because instead of the experience of walking into certain cafes and not really feeling welcomed, right? This was a place of pride. This, the origins of which came about as a result of the Great Migration. As with many small communities of color, it was from that. It was trying to move away from the atrocities of hate and racism and death and try to find a happy place where you felt welcomed. So even as I talk about it, I get very emotional because I think there is still a deliberate attempt to kind of at erasure wherever there is a congregation of people trying to just carve out a little bit of America for themselves, and they happen to be people of color. There is a deliberate attempt at erasure to just completely wipe it off the map. And we're going to rebuild, and we're going to come in, and we're going to make it modern, right? Modernize it. I think that is the fate of Altadena more so, and that people are, you know, those poachers are offering, I just read an article where someone offered $100,000 over the asking price of a property of 9,000+ acres. What do you think is going to happen? They're going to rebuild. Gentrification is real. And people will pay millions of dollars. They did it in the Crenshaw District. They did it in Compton. They did it in parts of El Segundo. They once called Inglewood and Linwood the Hood, Crenshaw District the Hood. And yet now, you know, there's developers that have come in and basically took away the opportunity for Black developers to purchase the Crenshaw Mall. And now they own it. So I think that we're going to see a revitalization of Altadena, and I think the history will be all but forgotten, except for the Friday night pizza dinners with family talking about the old days and keeping our history alive. I think this is another attempt, just as they're trying to eliminate Black literature and history, that they are trying to eliminate all elements of Black living. So I hope I'm around to see the revitalization, but I don't have a lot of hope that it will again be given to the communities of color, Black, Brown, AAPI communities of color there in Altadena. But it was a beautiful little space to hang out. Yeah.
Well, Law and Disorder is around to make sure the worst fears you have don't come true, and I know your organization is as well. What do you think are some ways that marginalized communities and their allies can respond and fight back to the injustices they are facing? How do all of us, all Americans, join in the fight for resistance and preservation of democracy in this country?
That's a big question. Just right off the bat, I would say by using our voice, by protesting, by calling our local officials, by voting, right? But all of the areas, the right places, by challenging laws, right? By community. I think that time and time again, it has proven that when you develop a community, that starts to protest, right? When you raise awareness, that starts the protest. When you are sitting on sit-ins and when you are voting the right people into office, that starts the protest. But I think personally that we have been so traumatized and silenced that many of us forget just how powerful our voices are. And so I would say community building, certainly democracy at its best, certainly continuing with icons and leaders like you in the civil rights movement to continue with the lawsuits, like flood the courthouses with lawsuits. And most importantly, that work, that neighborhood humanity, right, where you get to know your neighbors, and we become so isolated, it seems to me, we don't even know our neighbors anymore, right? And that is to ensure that people like Trump and others will never have the opportunity and challenge what he's doing now. For goodness sake, the man is a felon, times 40 plus. But somehow he made it on the ballot and he's the president of the United States, despite the insurrection. There wasn't enough pushback, in my opinion, to address that. I want to go back to community because I think community is very strong. I think if we can get it right and fight for each other, that we can fight for the basic element of justice. I truly believe that.
You said something earlier in this conversation that we need to know and recognize the power we naturally have. We have that power, and what you've talked about today has been empowering. As we wrap up, tell listeners how they can learn more about the National Immigration Law Center and your work.
Thank you, Steve. It's been an honor to sit and chat with you. And yes, the National Immigration Law Center, fondly known as NILC, ways that you can support the work that we do is to visit our website at nilc.org. We have toolkits that we have put out, Know Your Rights toolkits. We post some of the cases and some of the work that we've been doing. Another way is I humbly ask if you have a donation, $1, $5, it goes a long way. But we are fighting 24/7 for the rights of our communities, and we haven't stopped since 1979, and most importantly, the uptick with the Trump administration. I have an amazing team of colleagues in all walks of life, of civil rights, immigrant rights, justice, and we're fighting 24/7. And it wouldn't hurt to send out a positive affirmation of prayer that we continue with the fight and that we continue to be empowered to push when others say stop.
Sheila, I'm deeply moved by this conversation. I am grateful to you. Thank you very much for joining us on Law and Disorder, but thank you very much for waking up every morning, doing the work you're doing. This is a new friendship. We're going to stay in touch with you and get updates as your work and the struggle continues. Thank you, Sheila.
Steve, thank you for having me, and I look forward to the partnerships and opportunities in the future with you and your team. I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Four states have introduced bills or taken other steps that would restrict teaching critical race theory or limit how teachers can discuss racism and sexism. Critical race theory is an academic and legal framework that recognizes systemic racism in the United States. It challenges the idea that racism is abnormal or that it's just a result of individual bias. In late January, the Department of Defense issued a memo removing the recognition of history months, such as Black History Month, Women's History Month, and Pride Month, from its official observances, claiming such months somehow played a divisive role in American society. But we here at Law and Disorder still strongly believe such months can play a vital role in educating our diverse population on matters often given little or no attention in our lives or in our public schools around the nation. And so as far as we are concerned, this month, the month of February, is still Black History Month. And we've invited two guests, who believe as we do, to join us here on Law and Disorder today to discuss racism in America, both historic and present day. That in turn means that we will be examining aspects of critical race theory and considering why white America has so much fear of it being taught in our public schools. Our guests are Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, respectively publisher and editor of the LA Progressive, a daily online magazine widely read throughout the greater Los Angeles area and far beyond. Sharon Kyle is Black. Dick Price, who happens to be her husband, is white. Well, Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, a warm, warm welcome to the Law and Disorder radio show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Jim.
Yeah, great talking to you, Jim.
44 states now have introduced or passed laws forbidding the teaching of critical race theory. And it's worth remembering that in all of these 44 states, of course, Black legislators make up a very tiny percentage of their state's legislatures. But nevertheless, Cher, why do you think critical race theory is so unpopular? Is it not understood properly, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's more to it than that, but I do agree that it is not understood. One of the reasons I think it's not understood is because this is a complex theory. It's a theory that is taught in law school. So this notion that people in elementary school or high school are being taught critical race theory is really not true. Critical race theory originated with Derrick Bell, who has passed away now, but he was a trailblazing legal scholar. And he is the one that sought to flesh out the ways in which racism is baked into our justice system and our legal jurisprudence. So it really is misunderstood for a couple of reasons. One is the intention for it to be misunderstood. The other is it's way too complex and it's not being taught at the levels that they're suggesting. But it's also important to understand that the people, the powers that be, want the American experience to be seen through this lens of American exceptionalism, which is a myth. It's a myth that has never been true. We've never been this city, the shining city on the hill. We are a country full of human beings that are flawed. And just like any other country, we've got a long way to go before we really even have democracy. And so whenever you allow for the discussion of race, you're also going to allow the window to open to the discussion of racism.
When we hear opponents of critical race theory criticizing it, a familiar reframe we hear is that it's falsely teaching children that the U.S. has always been a racist country and that there is still racism today. And in fact, one of the main tenets of critical race theory is that racism is ordinary, that it's actually embedded in our society, and it's not simply the result of individual prejudices. And Dick, isn't this a rather irrefutable fact? What are your thoughts on that?
So oftentimes people who attack critical race theory, DEI, or woke don't actually seem to understand what the terms mean and don't care. They just want angry words to toss around because they can't hurl direct slurs about Black people. What they really want to do is preserve their individual and class advantage as white people. They want to keep white people on top of the pile where they've always been, and they see, rightly, that CRT, DEI, and woke are efforts to even the playing field. The way to judge whether racism exists is to look not at the words, not at the documents, not even at the laws, but at the results. And at every measure available, African Americans are disadvantaged to this day. Black men make 70% of what white men make. Black women make 82% of white women. Schools may have been legally desegregated long, long ago, but in fact, schools are more segregated today than they were in the 1960s. And Black schools are always the poorest in town. This doesn't happen by accident, but results from conscious and unconscious efforts to preserve historical advantages for white people, expensive black people especially, but also Latinos, Asian Americans, and Native American people.
One of the main tenets of critical race theory, of course, race itself is a social construct, not a biological reality. What is meant by that, and do you agree? And also, Sharon, another tenet of critical race theory is that of intersectionality. What this means is that race is not only identity that impacts a person's life, that it's, important to consider how race interacts with other identities of the person. Your thoughts on both intersectionality and on this notion that race is a social construct, not a biological reality.
Thanks, Jim. So first, let me start off by talking about the construction of race, because that's sort of a relatively new concept. Well, actually, both are new concepts. But from a scientific perspective, it wasn't until like the past 30 or 40 years that scientists finally came to the conclusion that race has no basis in biology. In fact, there is really only one race among humans, and that's the human race. So it's been broadly accepted that it is a construction. It's a social construction. So although race does not exist from a biological perspective, it does exist in a very big way from a social and legal perspective. So it's broadly accepted that since the late 1600s, the term white didn't even show up in the legal lexicon around the United States. Well, the United States didn't exist yet. In the colonies, the term white began to kind of float around after this major colonial rebellion called Bacon's Rebellion, which was an armed uprising in 1676 by Virginian colonists led by Nathaniel Bacon against the colonial governor, who was the British William Berkeley. And the reason that the colonists, the laborers were black, they were white, they were indentured servants, and they were working for the British to clear the land and to really to take the land from the Native Americans. And the reason that they were united and they were in solidarity, because there was no such thing as race. They saw themselves sharing in work, sharing in play, they cross-married, they lived together as one in solidarity. And they were very effective at throwing out the British. And as a result of them removing the governor of Virginia, so they came up with a masterful tactic, and that was they developed a way to divide and conquer. And they constructed the idea that white people were a race. Before that, white people never even heard of the term white people. They were the British, or they were the Irish, or they were the Scottish, or they were the Dutch, but they came to be known as the white people, and they were told that they had an advantage over the others. And that began the beginning of the construction of race and the unfair advantages and unfair disadvantages that were based on race. As the second part of your question is about intersectionality, Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a law professor, renowned law professor, she has been called the person who coined the term intersectionality. And she often tells a story of a company that from a statistical perspective, it looked like it had a diverse workforce. It had, on paper, it had a healthy number of black people working there. It had a healthy number of women working there. But she said that when you dug a little deeper, you found that black women didn't have a chance at being promoted, and they were grossly discriminated against. And this observation led to her further explorations and her coining this term intersectionality. Because when you looked at this company on paper, they looked like they were doing a great job. But what was happening was, because of the overlap of identities, black people were represented at the company, but that was black men. Women were represented at the company, those white women. So black women were ignored, and the discrimination they experienced was just overlooked. And that's when she came up with this term intersectionality, the overlapping of identities. And What she explains is that when you have an overlapping of identities, you also have a compounding of the negative consequences of those identities. So I'm going to get back to your question, and I guess your question boils down to what are my thoughts on intersectionality? I think it was brilliant for her to be able to discover this. For people like me, I am a Black woman and did experience both discrimination as from a gender perspective as well as from a sex perspective and as from a racial perspective.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall here with my co-host Jim Lafferty, and we're interviewing Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, longtime activists and publishers of LA Progressive, about on the subject of Black history. So would you agree that since the end of slavery, Black people and people of African descent have made considerable progress here in the U.S., such as having more laws on the books prohibiting racial discrimination, for example, in the workplace, housing market, and public accommodations? And if so, does that mean anti-Black racism has been fully eliminated, or does it still play a powerful role in American life? Why don't we start with Dick Price on this one?
Great. Thank you, Maria. Well, again, as I said earlier, on paper and in the law books, Blacks have made significant progress in fighting legal discrimination. On paper and in the law books. But the fact is, our society disadvantages Black people at every turn, as we all know, in hiring, in promotions, in education, in housing, in health care, in longevity. Maybe Black people can't be denied equal opportunities explicitly legally, but there are subtle forces at play to accomplish much the same thing. Ask any Black person you know about deserved jobs and promotions they've been denied for not very good reasons. Ask them about the differential treatment they receive in stores, at the hospital, going for a loan, especially dealing with the police. Those subtle discriminations are terribly weathering. A weathering that fuels anger and despair, a weathering that shortens lives.
Dick, you once told me an interesting story about a Black woman friend of yours who, when she goes shopping for clothes, has to do it in a rather unusual way, a way that the average white woman would not. I think that's a great example of what you've just been talking about. Tell our audience that story, please.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We have a very distinguished friend, a professor, a woman, well-known in the public, elegant, looks like a model, who has given up shopping in the high-toned stores she liked to shop in because every time she would go in, she would be followed by the security guards. It got so, I mean, it was painful to her. It was part of that weathering that I was talking about. She had to hire somebody to do her shopping for her, even though she really likes to do the shopping herself.
So thank you for the question, Jim. I want to make it clear that the Black Lives Matter grassroots movement is still going strong. It's operating across the country. I attend Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, but there are Black Lives Matter at various places across the country. I want to place an emphasis on the words grassroots. It is Black Lives Matter grassroots, and that's what Black Lives Matter is about. Now, I want to move on to asking, well, why is the case that we're having such a hard time, and why is it that racism continues to persist? And the reason that it continues to persist is twofold. One is racial illiteracy. We live in a country that is arguably the most racially diverse country in the world, and yet we have a degree of racial illiteracy that really is, in my mind, a threat to public safety. And we have the dissemination of misinformation about race that is served up by the ruling class. So they do things like demonize terms like DEI, or terms like affirmative action. So they mislead, but people are easily misled because they don't have the racial literacy to be able to combat the misinformation. So those two things go hand in hand in eradicating racism. And so in my mind, it is not until we have a clear understanding that racism has a negative impact on all of us. It's not until that happens, which comes with the racial literacy, that we'll be able to confront it. Lonnie Guinier, who was a person that I adored, and sadly she passed away a couple of years ago, but she wrote a book called The Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, and Transforming Democracy. She wrote it with Gerald Torres. And she maintained, she and Gerald both maintained that, like canaries that are alerted, that alerted miners to a poisonous atmosphere, issues of race point to the underlying problems in society that ultimately affect everyone. And so I recently heard of a term called diseases of despair. And what diseases of despair discuss or focus on is the lowering of the life expectancy that is happening right now in the United States across all races. It used to be that only Black people were really plagued with these diseases of despair, which include alcoholism, overdose, overdoses of illicit drugs, suicide, alcohol liver disease. These, which are called diseases of despair and the resulting deaths of despair, are high now in Appalachia, in especially in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Delaware. White people, poor white people, are being impacted in ways that they never had been impacted before. So in answer to your question, what do we have to do to end racism? We need to improve racial literacy, combat misinformation, and understand that this is in the best interest of all of us.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. And at the moment, we were interviewing Dick Price and Sharon Kyle, who together publish a online daily newsletter called the LA Progressive. It's a wonderful publication. You should look it up online and check it out for yourselves. You don't have to live in LA to appreciate the stories in it. Many of them are international or certainly national. I want to ask a follow-up question from what you were just talking about, Sharon, and I'll put it to Dick to start, but you can both then jump in. One of the things that you hear often from white racists, especially, even white liberals would be somehow, quote unquote, forced to admit certain aspects of what I'm about to say without a deeper understanding. And that is, they point to the same way that people point to immigrants and say, well, look at all the crimes they commit, when in fact, of course, they commit fewer crimes percentage-wise than do citizens of the United States. Look at Black people. Look at all the crimes they commit. Why are there so a disproportionate number of them in our prisons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A disproportionate number of them on welfare. There must be something inherently wrong with being Negroid, with being Black, if you will. How do you respond to that?
So I talked earlier about the concept of weathering and the fact that a lifetime of discrimination creates a kind of despair. Sharon was just talking about despair. And you can deal with despair in several ways. You can also deal with poverty because of the unequal treatment. More Black people are in poverty. And one of the ways is you drink a lot. You use drugs. You commit crimes. You get caught. You have no money for an attorney. You go to jail. I mean, I think if you accounted for poverty and lack of opportunity across the races, white people and Black people, you would see not that much of a difference between white people who are in prison and Black people. And the impetus for that would not necessarily be the color of their skin, but the lack of opportunity and the closed doors they faced in the society they lived in.
And I'd like to add to that, this Black on Black crime, that term has been stricken from many independent media outlets because the truth of the matter is it's not grounded in fact. Crime is committed across racial boundaries, and typically crime is committed within a race. So whites will typically commit crimes against other white people, blacks commit crimes against other black people, and so on. It's because we live in such a profoundly segregated country and because of the proliferation of guns. But there really is not a significant difference in the way the criminal behavior of black people and the criminal behavior of white people.
Yes, and also, is it not also the case that there is such great disparity in the sentencing of black and white defendants? They live in the same community. They come before the same courts. They are convicted. But when it comes time for sentencing, it's been shown over and over again with studies that much harsher sentences are put on the black defendants who in that community who've been found guilty of selling some marijuana or stealing clothes from a local clothes store or whatever the crime might be. In fact, I know of a study in Michigan, a big study in Michigan, which showed that in death penalty cases, black people who were found guilty of killing black people were rarely sentenced to death, but black people who killed white people were constantly sentenced to death. And you could find other disparities as well. So I'm wondering, is that not a sign that racism is still alive and well in the United States today? And does that not warp the way people look at the relative criminal rates of both races, of both aspects of this same one human race?
Well, I have two stories. One story is that the laws are canted against black people. And let's take the episode of powder cocaine against rock cocaine. It's the same drug. Actually, crack cocaine has less cocaine in it. But at one time, the disparity in the sentences you would get from possessing crack cocaine were 10, 20 times as much as for powder cocaine. So if you got caught for powder cocaine, you might get a year. If you had crack cocaine, you might get 10.
And I'd like to interject here that powder cocaine, it was known, was used more by white people, whereas crack cocaine was used more by black people. So even though the language never even talked about the differences from a racial perspective, it was understood and known that if you increase the penalties on crack cocaine, you're going to lock up more black people.
So the second story I had is we had a fundraiser for George Gascon, our former wonderful district attorney here in Los Angeles County. And he was asked, why are the police locking up so many more young black men for smoking marijuana, for possessing it? And he said, well, you know, the white kids who are smoking marijuana are doing it in their backyard up in their house in Bel Air. The black kids who are poor and don't have a backyard, they're smoking it on the street corner. So who are the police going to find? They're going to find the black kids on the street corner.
Another example, is it not, of the fact that poverty plays such a role in whether or not you end up in the grips of the police and whether or not you end up in prison or not. It affects the price of the lawyer. If you have to depend on an overworked and understaffed public defender's office, you may not fare so well. If you have enough money to hire a lawyer, but not to hire the great lawyer of your community, it's going to affect your sentencing. And as I've just said, it's going to affect the sentence you get in any event because of the prejudice of judges in rendering sentences. That's been shown all over the place, is it not? So poverty plays a great role as well in what happens to people of color and how they are perceived, therefore, by white folks, does it not?
Absolutely, Jim. You know, you're talking about the overlapping of identities, and one of those identities is class. As the gulf between the haves and the have-nots in the United States continues to grow, more and more white people are falling into poverty. So they're going to be experiencing a lot of the problems that the black community has historically experienced. It compounds on top of, for black people, poverty compounds on top of racism and makes the problems even more exacerbated.
Sadly, we're out of time, Sharon and Dick. We are going to have to let you go. But before we do, can you recommend for our listening audience some books or magazines or other places where they could get some good information that would elaborate even further on what we've been talking about today.
Yeah, Jim, you know, I didn't know you were going to ask that question. So I'm bringing up, I have a list. Boy, do I have a list, but I'm not going to tell you everybody that I have on list. But I do, I want to mention writers. Here we go. Joy DeGruy. Joy DeGruy wrote Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, and she offers an excellent analysis of the legacy of slavery on both Black people, and it's important for whites and others to understand how this PTSS, post-traumatic slave syndrome, is still visible today. Kelly Lytle Hernandez is an author, a brilliant historian, a professor of history at UCLA. Kelly Lytle, L-Y-T-L-E, Hernandez.
Sharon Kyle and Dick Bice, thank you so very much for joining us on Law and Disorder today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.